Hey there, friends. A quick favor. We are conducting a brief audience survey. We'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes to provide your answers. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to complete it. That's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you. President Biden is setting a new course with China, but the trade war is still on. So are Trump's tariffs.
They're kind of a bargaining chip, and there are a lot of chips that you want to have on the table in front of you when you are dealt your hand.
Also, can Chinatown survive the pandemic? Without tourists, restaurants from New York to L.A. are shutting down.
We are losing a piece of American history. It's a living immigrant community that's existed for over 150 years.
And in Germany, LGBTQ actors coming out en masse at once.
How I feel now is incredible. I really feel that I put this shame that is always put on me. I put it aside. Now it can be the shame of someone else.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Welcome to Friday. President Biden had his first official phone call with China's leader Xi Jinping this week. They spoke about human rights, Hong Kong, and trade. President Trump had engaged Beijing in a two-year trade war. This week we learned that President Biden has not called a truce. Joining me now is economist Michael Klein with the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He's also the executive editor of EconoFact, a website that explains complex economic topics for the rest of us. Michael, welcome back to the show. Trump's weapon of choice in his trade war has been tariffs. Economists don't agree on everything, but most agree on this, that tariffs are a dull instrument to accomplish your goals. But Biden this week said the tariffs will remain in place for the time being. What do you make of that?
Well, the tariffs, as you stated, are not really that good an instrument to preserve manufacturing jobs. For instance, the tariffs on aluminum may help some workers in the aluminum industry, but they're going to hurt workers for industries where aluminum is an input to production, cars, boats, even aluminum cans. So overall, while it might target help in some industries, it could have a much bigger and adverse effect on a wider range of industries.
Remind me and our listeners why President Trump started the trade war with China.
Well, that's a good question, actually. When he put in place the tariffs on steel and aluminum, he referred to Section 232, which was saying that the fact that there was not enough domestic production of steel and aluminum was a national security threat. Most people discounted this and thought of it more as a fig leaf, and it was just part of his overall America First policy. But what happened was that in his last day in office, for example, he removed the tariffs on the United Arab Emirates. And that was seen by many as an act that had nothing to do with economics, but had to do with brokering the peace between the UAE and Israel. So it's not clear that there really was a coherent economic reason behind the tariff policy of President Trump.
There have been a lot of downsides to the trade war. Consumers pay more for products. American businesses are scrambling to find new supply chains. It has also strained U.S.-China relations. But the goals, evening the trade playing field, those haven't really been accomplished. So why keep the tariffs in place?
And I think they're a bargaining chip. There are certainly things to be concerned about in our economic relationships with China, intellectual property, for example. These are best addressed through a multilateral approach. So tariffs are one way to get a high-profile action that your electorate sees, but it's not clear that economically it really has that big a benefit.
Michael, what would be a better way than tariffs for the Biden administration to achieve his goals and re-engage with China?
I think the ultimate goal in terms of the economy is really not to engage with China. There are things to do with China, but the ultimate goal is to help the middle class. And so we have to think about how to help people. And trade is a convenient sort of boogeyman for this, but it's not clear that addressing trade is really the best way to help people enter and stay in the middle class.
Would you expect Biden to lift these tariffs ultimately? And when do you think that might happen?
That's really hard to say. Again, they're kind of a bargaining chip. And there are a lot of chips that you want to have on the table in front of you when you are dealt your hand. So It depends on how he wants to approach it, what he sees is an opportunity to give some things up in order to get other things that he wants. So I see this more as a political decision and an effort to try to have something behind him that he can use when he's negotiating over a range of different issues.
Press Secretary Jen Psaki says essentially Biden is going to watch and wait now. What does come next?
Well, this is not a one-person game. It's a two-person game. So you have to see how the other side responds as well. It's like in chess. You know, what you do depends upon what your opponent does. And you can plan contingent on different kinds of moves. And I'm sure the administration is doing that. But it really depends upon what happens, not only with China, but with other countries as well. And if they're going to move with the United States, for example, who are our allies, who are also concerned with China, or if the United States is kind of left out alone to deal with these things. So it's a multidimensional game, and it's hard to predict what's going to happen next when there are so many contingencies.
Michael Klein is a professor of international economic affairs at Tufts University. Great to have you with us today, Michael. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
This week, South Africa halted its rollout of one of the main COVID vaccines, Oxford AstraZeneca. The timing is far from ideal. South Africa has been hit hard by the coronavirus. Tens of thousands of people have died, more than any other country on the continent. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
South Africa had its vaccine plan ready. This month, a million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine arrived in the country. South Africa was already conducting a local trial of that vaccine, but it yielded some unexpected results. Minister of Health Zwelin Mkhize spoke about it during a recent press conference.
It was established that the AstraZeneca vaccine does not prevent mild to moderate disease of the 501YV2 variant.
The 501YV2 variant is the technical name for the variant that was identified in South Africa in November. Because of the findings, the government decided to temporarily halt the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Jeffrey Mfrele is a leading virologist and is a member of the country's Ministerial Advisory Group for Coronavirus. He says it wasn't an easy decision.
It is a difficult one for South Africa, especially because we already, you know, made advances to use the vaccine. We have ordered the vaccine. We have got a stock in South Africa.
A difficult but necessary step, he said. He stresses that the AstraZeneca vaccine was a good option. It's cheap, stores easily, and works well against the original variant. But South Africa is in a unique situation. The new variant now accounts for most new coronavirus cases in the country. Scientists say it also spreads more easily.
I think ethically, it will not be right, you know, to use it. Because whether you like it or not, if people get a vaccine, they get a sense of protection.
South Africa has had to quickly change course with its vaccine rollout and deal with the social backlash and misunderstandings around the decision. Mfakhele says South Africans are no strangers to vaccines, but there's been misinformation and fake news around the COVID vaccine. Bongani Mazibuko is with the Democratic Nursing Organization of South Africa. He says the announcement caused confusion, even among health workers who will be the first to get the vaccine. Some are hesitant, he says.
And the hesitance is due to lack of information and the number of fake news that has been circulating.
Still, Mazibuko says he was happy about the announcement. For him, it's a sign that the government is being more transparent about its vaccination plan. Before, Mazibuko says the government wasn't communicating its plans with health workers. Now is a chance to rectify that.
We are currently in discussions with the provincial government on the vaccine rollout plan, so that we can be able to be on par and be able to give our members the correct information.
On Thursday, South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, said they had secured 9 million batches of a vaccine by Johnson & Johnson. That one is effective against moderate and severe cases of the new coronavirus variant. It's still waiting for regulatory approval, but the first batch of doses are expected to arrive in the country next week. That still leaves the question of what happens to the 1 million AstraZeneca doses left in the country. Minister of Health Zwelé Mkhize says there are options, including exchanging the vaccines with other countries.
There are already some countries who are asking that we must sell it to them. All we can say to our public is that we will not waste the money.
But this doesn't spell the end of the AstraZeneca vaccine in South Africa. The country's top scientist noted that the study doesn't indicate whether the AstraZeneca vaccine could protect against severe cases of the variant. They've said more research is needed. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization's expert panel has recommended countries continue to use a vaccine even with the presence of variants. The Africa Centers for Disease Control has said the same for countries that don't have the South Africa variant. Mfahele, the vaccine expert, said this whole ordeal is a reality check. The virus is changing. So too will the vaccines.
I think that the way forward would be that the vaccines will be improved. They will be adapted. And I think that will solve the problem.
Multiple drug manufacturers have plans to develop next-generation vaccines that will protect against variants of the virus. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Ever had a really noisy neighbor? It is the worst. Of course, I'm sure our neighbors hear our own hubbub. Yeah, we also got to point the finger at ourselves. The ocean has a message for all of us. Pipe down. The world's Anna Kusmer explains.
When Jana Vinderen first sunk a microphone underwater in a lake in Norway, she couldn't believe all the sounds.
I remember, the first time I was actually putting the hydrophones in the water and realizing, my God, it's a really interesting world under there.
Vinderen is an artist who has traveled around the world capturing rich underwater soundscapes. These are her recordings.
From the bearded seals in the Arctic, you can hear them very clearly. Or there is like the grunting of Norwegian pollock from a fjord.
Then, of course, bottlenose dolphins off the coast of Florida. And humpback whales in waters off the Dominican Republic. Vinderen says hearing these sounds this clearly is actually pretty rare. They're often drowned out by humans.
You know, there could be pumps, there could be like boat engines. There are all sorts of human-created sounds.
Scientists now have a better idea just how much these human sounds are impacting animals. Vinderen was a co-author on a study published this month that analyzed 10,000 studies on noise pollution in oceans. It found that all types of animals rely on sound in the ocean, not just dolphins and whales, but shrimp, oysters, snails, and jellyfish too. Carlos Duarte at King Abdullah University in Saudi Arabia led the study.
Sound as the main ecological glue for animals to sense the marine environment.
And human noises are impacting thousands of species' ability to mate, navigate, and forage for food.
That is making it hard for organisms to communicate, is displacing organisms from the habitat, weakening and creating a burden on the animals.
It's also stressing them out. Many fish release stress hormones when it's noisy underwater. Things quieted down last year when COVID lockdowns reduced noise pollution in the oceans by 20%. Animals started being spotted in unusual places.
Very close to shore and very close to otherwise very busy waterways where they had not been seen for decades or generations.
That respite for animals was temporary, but Duarte says it doesn't have to be. He recommends permanent things like building with sound-absorbing materials and putting quieter propellers on ships.
And actually at the same time, they become more energy efficient. So that is an economically appealing option.
Duarte says unlike climate change and ocean pollution, this problem could, in theory, be solved quickly. Duarte asks people to imagine what life is like underwater. If we can be just a little quieter, we can make the ocean a little friendlier for the animals who live there. For The World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Today is the Chinese New Year. Welcome the Year of the Ox. Chinese New Year is usually a time for celebration. Streets and restaurants overflow with food and festivities. The pandemic, though, has been devastating for these Chinese communities. Chinatowns across the U.S. have seen a drop-off in tourism. Restaurants have been some of the hardest-hit casualties, partly because of economic pressures, also because of xenophobia. Last spring, I spoke with award-winning cookbook author Grace Young about the impacts in New York's Chinatown.
I don't think Chinatown as we know it will ever be the same again. And a lot of the businesses definitely won't survive.
Now, almost a year later, we thought we'd check in with Grace Young to find out how the community is doing in New York. Grace, welcome back.
Thank you, Marco.
Just give us a picture of what New York's Chinatown looks like these days. And I'm talking the one in Manhattan. I know there's also kind of a big Chinatown out in Flushing. How are they both doing?
Well, actually, in the metropolitan area, we have 9 Chinatowns.
Wow.
So we have Sunset Park in Brooklyn. There are a lot of small Chinatowns. But I live in Manhattan, and Manhattan's Chinatown is hurting the most out of all the Chinatowns because, like San Francisco's Chinatown, it's not dependent on locals. It's dependent on tourism and also office workers within the area. And it's also dependent on students, university students that go to Chinatown because meals are cheap and inexpensive, and it's lost all of that.
And in years past, I mean, do you happen to know the numbers? Like, how many people would Chinatown typically attract?
Well, in 2019, Manhattan had 67 million tourists.
Wow.
So even if we were missing 1 million tourists, can you imagine the impact on Chinatown? So with 67 million tourists and lower Manhattan workers were missing 300,000. And also adjacent to Manhattan's Chinatown are the courts. So normally when you were doing jury duty, everyone would just go to Chinatown because it was the best and easiest food to get.
So clearly locals alone cannot sustain the community when you have that many tourists coming into the city. When we last spoke, you were in the midst of documenting some of the restaurants and the effect that lockdown measures were having on them. You spoke to the owners, Peter Lee of Hop Key and Mei Chow of Ose Peace, a Malaysian French restaurant. Where are they now and what's happened to their restaurants?
So Ose Peace did not last. I went in to see her almost every day, and she said she had never worked harder in her life, and she was doing 20% of the business she had done pre-COVID. And by June, she closed. Hop Key is one of our legacy restaurants in Chinatown. It opened in 1968. I haven't talked to Peter recently, but most restaurants in New York City's Chinatown are doing about 20 or 30% of the business they did pre-COVID.
In Chinatown, when restaurants go under, what is lost culturally? I mean, obviously there's the economic loss, but what's lost culturally?
That's a great question. To me, these restaurants and businesses hold our memories, and they're our connection to our past. So it's so, right now, San Francisco's Chinatown is struggling for survival. Manhattan's Chinatown is also in the same position. And if we lose these two historic Chinatowns, we are losing a piece of American history. It's a living immigrant community that's existed for over 150 years. And it's not just about Chinese immigrants. Irish, Italian, Jewish immigrants lived in those tenement buildings in Manhattan's Chinatown. So my great fear is as each one of these businesses close, it opens the way for gentrification. And within a short amount of time, it's conceivable there could be a Trader Joe's or a CVS on Mott Street or Grant Avenue. We once had 50 Chinatowns in America, and now we're just down to a handful. Philadelphia, a shell of its former Chinatown. Portland, Oregon, Los Angeles, the original Chinatown, barely there. So we have to protect these historic immigrant communities. It represents one of the great centers for Chinese culture and cuisine in America.
Grace, you're actively taking on one slice of this. It's an important slice. Mei Chow, who we spoke about earlier at Ose Peace, employed housewives who were her cooks. It's a kind of stark reminder that many workers who have lost jobs are disproportionately women. You've helped launch a nationwide campaign now on social media called hashtag Save Chinese Restaurants, just helping the few mom-and-pop Chinese restaurants still around. Beyond this campaign, what else is needed to keep this, keep these businesses afloat?
I just want to say that the campaign is on Instagram, and I partnered with the Beard Foundation to do it. And the hope is that people will go to their local Chinese restaurant, post a photo of their favorite dish, and tell their friends and followers to do the same, and that there can really be this movement all across the country that we show up for these poor mom-and-pop businesses.
Hashtag Save Chinese Restaurants. I know I'm going to my local Sichuan this weekend and getting the mapo tofu, and I'm going to photograph it. James Beard Award-winning cookbook author Grace Young, thank you for your time again.
Thank you, Marco.
From an economic perspective, the pandemic has upended the way many of us conduct business. Perhaps the biggest change is how quickly we've gone digital, like full-on digital, the way we work, shop, communicate. Businesses have had to adjust quickly. That includes banks. Going forward, banks are going to have to figure out how to make a switch to digital currency. That's just one of the many things discussed about banking in this week's episode of The Economist Asks, a podcast brought to us by our partners at Economist Radio. Christine Lagarde is president of the European Central Bank. Here's part of her conversation with Zanny Minton-Beddoes, editor-in-chief of The Economist.
We should have a digital currency, which will not exclude banknotes. We should have a digital currency that is respectful of privacy, which is not selling data, which is not exploiting the data of people that are using it. A digital currency that also uses the canal of banks, because banks will be part and parcel in that digital currency launch. And then we will have to, you know, refine it to the point that it is completely safe, secure, and can be used effectively with less cost, more security, and on a voluntary basis.
And what's the timing of this? Are we talking, you know, in the next year or two? Or is this a kind of, you know, beyond your presidency kind of thing?
Oh, no, 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 no. You know, we look at how long it took China to get there. They started 6 years ago. They're not live yet. They've been saying for about a year that they're ready to go, but they haven't gone. I hope less than the time it took them, because hopefully the learning curve will be shorter. It's hard to say, but I would say in the next 4 years, we should be there.
That was Christine Lagarde, president of the European Central Bank, this week's guest on the Economist Asks podcast. You can hear the full conversation wherever you get your podcasts. Look for The Economist Asks. It is Friday, and we thought we'd highlight some of the music featured on The World recently. So grab some headphones and head over to our Twitter feed. That's at The World. You'll find links to those stories. So turn it up, relax, dance, whatever moves you. You're listening to The World. Marco Werman here. It takes a lot to keep the world spinning, but it's listeners like you from all around the globe who spinned for us and helped us exceed our goal of $100,000. These are some of our supporters who span time zones and borders to help keep the world free for everyone. Tomomi Imai, Ben Yuang, Thomas Jones, Arun Matthew, Beth Kakuma Depew, Edward Barris, Jennifer Lale, Bob Wolfson, Christy Jaden, and Avery Walsh. You are fantastic people. Thank you for helping us bring global reporting to millions of people around the world. Oh, the intricacies of Brexit. For British pop stars, touring in Europe just got a heck of a lot harder.
It feels like an absolute car crash. A musician that was based in America can tour more freely in Europe than we can, which is nuts.
And a rapping U.S. diplomat wishes you a happy Lunar New Year. That's all ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. 2 years ago, the U.S. and Brazil signed a space agreement. It allowed U.S. companies to launch satellites from northeastern Brazil. Brazil is now looking to expand its space base, but that could evict hundreds of Afro-Brazilian families from their ancestral land. Michael Fox has more.
In the early 1980s, in the final years of the military dictatorship, hundreds of families were removed from their land in northeastern Brazil to make way for the construction of the new Alcantara Satellite Launch Center. The families were relocated to inland villages known as agrovilas. The government promised food, employment, and support. Little was provided. Leandra Silveira was a young mother at the time.
Pois assim que eu vim chorando, uma mulher da idade que eu vim para cá, She says she cried like a child the day they were relocated from their ancestral home to the Pepitel Agrovilla. She says it was hard when they arrived. They were given concrete shells of houses far from the coast, their fruit trees, their fields, and fishing spots. She says they only survived with the help from other communities that brought them food or allowed them to fish on their lands. Those neighboring lands could take hours to reach by bicycle or foot. These families also never received the titles to their new homes, until now.
Hoje é momento especial. Parece uma cerimônia simples.
That's President Jair Bolsonaro at an event this week in Alcântara to deliver land titles to 125 families who were relocated in the 1980s. He was joined by several cabinet officials, including his firebrand Minister of Women and Family, Damares Alves, a former evangelical preacher.
É de vocês, durmam felizes agora. É isso que o presidente Bolsonaro veio fazer.
She said, it's your land. You can rest easy now. That's why Bolsonaro is here. Despite the image, analysts and local leaders say this is not a case of historic redress, but rather PR and an attempt to actually undercut the unity of the local community.
All of the area outside the existing just under 9,000 hectares of the base is under a standing Brazilian, a binding Brazilian judicial order for collective land title.
That's Sean Mitchell, a Rutgers professor of anthropology who wrote a book about the launch site and its conflict with the local community.
So these titles that Bolsonaro is handing out are of dubious legal standing.
That's because this whole region is composed of quilombos, or communities of people of African descent, mostly formed after the end of slavery. There are more than 3,000 quilombos across Brazil. Dozens surround the Alcântara launch site. They're home to roughly 800 families who are now scheduled to be removed to make way for the expansion of the launch center. Danilo Cerejo is a lawyer with the movement of people affected by the Alcântara launch site. He was raised in the Canelachiua quilombo.
Então nunca nesses 40 anos a ameaça de remoção dessas comunidades foi.
He says, never in these 40 years has the threat of removal of these communities been so real, because the Bolsonaro government is known around the world as one that does not respect the Constitution or legislation. And it's a government that is clearly racist. From the Mamuna Quilombo's communal yucca fields, residents can see the top of the installations of the Alcântara Satellite Launch Center, which borders their land. They're sustainable farmers. They fish in the ocean, a short walk from the village. Lorenza Vera strolls past the garden behind her tiny home, which is made of mud and a thatched roof. Her family has lived on these lands for generations. She says, we are being threatened today, just like in the past. We are at risk of being extinct. We are living the same things as in the past, running the risk of being extinct from our place of origin, our roots, and our identity. There has been pushback, both in Brazil and the United States. Georgia Congressman Hank Johnson spoke out against the U.S.-Brazil deal in September 2019.
This agreement between the Trump and Bolsonaro administrations threatens to displace hundreds of Afro-Brazilian Quilombo families from their land, further disparaging an already marginalized community.
Late last year, Johnson and other congressional members, including Deb Haaland and Senator Bernie Sanders, wrote to the Armed Services Committee to request that the 2021 Defense Authorization Bill prohibit the U.S. from cooperating with projects that would lead to the relocation of indigenous or quilombola communities in Brazil. Davy Pereira Jr. is a doctoral student at the University of Texas who grew up in the Alcântara Quilombo of Itamataciúa.
Para a gente, o que chama a atenção do governante, que tem uma possibilidade de...
He says, the fact that we were able to call the attention of U.S. politicians was important for us. Without pressure from the U.S. society, it will be very difficult to confront this. The new Biden administration may offer a window of opportunity. But Pereira Jr. and Quilombo lawyer Danilo Cerejo aren't holding their breath. While the planned evictions are now on hold, Quilombo leaders hope to keep the pressure on in both Brazil and the United States. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Hail Britannia, hail Britpop. From the Stones to Harry Styles, from Dusty Springfield to Dizzy Rascal. Hard to argue with the talent and productivity in the UK. Then Brexit happened, and now British musicians say the industry is in jeopardy. New Brexit rules mean British performers can't tour freely across Europe anymore. As the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports from London, musicians are warning this could be a career killer.
At this time of year, bass player Ben Ellis is usually preparing to go on tour with Iggy Pop, playing at crowded venues like this one in Belgium.
Well, here comes Johnny, yeah, and again. He got a little bit of drugs and a flask of steel.
But for the past 11 months, coronavirus has put an end to all that.
Everything we were going to do got cancelled, and this year I think it's going to be the same. I don't think we're going to see big festivals outdoors this year.
Scottish-born Ellis has been playing with Iggy Pop for the past 7 years. Many of their gigs are at festivals in Europe, which makes the new Brexit rules all the more infuriating, he says. Before January 1st this year, British artists could travel without a visa through the EU's 27 other member countries. Now, performers like Ellis may have to secure a visa and a work permit for every country on a European tour. Ellis says the new rules verge on the ridiculous.
It feels like an absolute car crash. There's no provision to enable musicians to be able to go out and work in Europe. A musician that was based in America, for example, now can tour more freely in Europe than we can, which is nuts.
Jazz saxophonist Binker Golding is equally frustrated. Golding is an award-winning British musician, but he depends on European tours for the majority of his income. He says the rules show just how little thought the UK government gave to artists during the Brexit talks.
They're saying, we couldn't give a toss if you survive or not, and I'm not being too dramatic. Imagine somebody making a decision which cut 50% of your income when that decision didn't have to happen.
Golding and Ellis are in a better position than many musicians. They're well established. For performers just starting out, Golding says, there could hardly be a worse time.
Some band somewhere was going to do their first tour. Some band somewhere was going to do their first album. Some students somewhere were leaving music school after 4 years of being there and racking up 40 grand's worth of debt. Those people I really feel sorry for.
And it's not just musicians who suffer under the new Brexit rules. Sound engineers, lighting designers and anyone working backstage in the business is going to face similar hurdles. Touring companies will likely be stopped at every border point to have their equipment checked. Tim Brennan is a camera director who's toured across Europe with some of the biggest acts in the business.
Madonna, Lady Gaga, Peter Gabriel, the Chemical Brothers, Morrissey, Meatloaf, all sorts.
Brennan has barely worked in the last 11 months. And now, because of Brexit, he's losing future jobs too.
I myself have been contacted by a company that I used to work for that are based in the States. And I've done a few tours for them. And they've said to me, until this gets sorted out, we can't use you because your limited travel availability compared to someone from the EU, it's 27 to 1 sort of thing.
Brennan was so angry with the new law, he started a petition calling on the government to negotiate a visa-free travel permit for British artists in Europe. The petition got a lot of attention and even sparked a parliamentary debate this week. During the video conference with MPs, Culture Minister Caroline Dynage said the UK government has done its best for musicians.
We listened to experts in British music and we reflected their views honestly in our proposal to the EU. Quite simply, Chair, the EU rejected this proposal.
The EU, for its part, says it was the Brits who rejected their offer. That included a special deal for performers. Dynage says she's still listening to the artists' concerns, and some industry people think the door may not be shut just yet on a deal. Liam Budd is with the trade body called the Incorporated Society of Musicians.
I think the government have made clear that they are very open to making progress on this issue. And that's, I think, the main thing is, I suppose, moving away from the blame game and actually just trying to find a solution, which is our top priority for the moment.
Elton John and Radiohead joined the chorus of angry musicians this week, and camera director Tim Brennan says he won't give up his campaign. But with no big gigs on the horizon, Brennan is now retraining as an electrician. And he considers himself one of the lucky ones, he says. At least he has the option of another career to turn to. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
In today's digital age, there are only a few days of the year where print newspapers totally sell out anymore. It happened in Germany recently, a different kind of banner headline. On the front page of one of the country's biggest papers, nearly 200 actors came out as members of the LGBTQ community. Copies flew off the stands. The movement is called Act Out, and the actors say they're not staying silent anymore. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
Karen Honcheski spent years hearing about the anti-LGBTQ discrimination that her fellow queer actors faced.
I know casting agents who told actors they know that they are queer, but they told them, don't go publicly out because then I cannot give you any auditions anymore.
Honcheski experienced similar situations herself. About a year and a half ago, she was at a film festival with her girlfriend. Before they arrived at the event, Honcheski's agent offered some unsolicited advice.
My agent told me that it would be better if she doesn't go with me on pictures or on the red carpet. People told us to be invisible. And of course, this hurts.
For her, that was the last straw. She decided she was going to do it. She would come out despite the risk of losing her career. But instead of just changing her own reality, Honcheski says she wanted to make structural change, and she'd need help to do it.
I was like, oh my God, I have to be part. It felt like really urgent, like I needed to be part.
Jules Elting is one of the 185 actors who ended up participating in Act Out. Elting says coming out as non-binary with such a large group felt empowering and momentous. But the significance didn't hit until they saw that front page of the South German newspaper. It was covered with the names and photos of all 185 actors.
It was so emotional because I went really from picture to picture and I said hello and thank you to every person, like, for their courage and acknowledging each life story, which is so different.
Each actor's experience is different. The group includes people of all genders and sexual orientations, German actors with intersectional identities from a range of generations. Still, they share the same goals. Elting says one change they're looking for is more LGBTQ characters on screen.
I have never seen a non-binary character at all on German TV, you know? Or in German cinema, like we just don't exist. That's really also beautiful because I feel like, wow, I'm going to be able to change something and play a character that can be like a role model, sorry, for somebody to see themselves and like recognize themselves.
Lamin Leroy Jibba wants the same thing. He's a Black queer actor who says German media doesn't mirror German streets.
When you walk around, you see so many different people with different perspectives and different lives and different identities, but it's just not reflected in the media. I've never seen myself on German television or in German movies or on German stages.
When Jibba says never, he really means it.
LGBTQ just does not exist.
Professor Elizabeth Prommer researches diversity in German media at the University of Rostock. She studied thousands of roles on TV and in film, trying to figure out the percentage of gay and lesbian characters.
And we had so few non-heterosexual characters that I cannot give you a percentage. It was just a handful of 11,000 characters.
Not even 1%. All of the actors I spoke with say media execs largely blame these abysmal stats on German audiences. They think queer stories are a niche genre that won't be relatable or bring in enough cash. Karin Honcheski says the Act Out movement disproves that.
The audience seems to be quite ready because I get messages like daily, 10, 20 messages of the audience that share with me. They are so grateful and they say that now that we did it, they can live a little bit more free now.
Overall, response to this mass coming out has been positive. Along with selling out those newspaper stands, film institutions, TV networks, and major theaters have said they stand in solidarity with the actors. Lamin Leroy Jibba is waiting for the follow-up.
I'm just now very curious to see what concrete actions, how they're going to make the industry that we are all in more inclusive and more diverse and equitable.
Honcheski admits there's still some fear that things won't change, that she and her fellow actors will lose work.
But putting this fear aside is so empowering. How I feel now is incredible. I really feel that I put this shame that is always put on me. I put it aside. Now it can be the shame of someone else. It's not my shame.
ACT OUT members know there's a long road to equality and diversity on screen. But with a growing list of LGBTQ actors now visible, it's a journey they feel ready to take. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
We were talking earlier on the show about the Lunar New Year, which kicks off today. People all over the world are celebrating. In Vietnam, the American ambassador got in on the action by releasing a rap video celebrating Tet, the Vietnamese Lunar New Year. And if you're thinking, who is the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam right now? Don't worry, the rap has you covered.
Time for introductions are at hand. Hi, my name is Dan. I'm from Nebraska. I'm not a big city boy. Then 3 years ago, I moved to Hanoi.
Dan is Daniel Crittenbrink, a career diplomat who previously served at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. In the video, the gray-haired, bespectacled ambassador is in a suit looking, well, looking like a diplomat. Crittenbrink holds red envelopes filled with cash given as gifts during Tet and hangs out with Vietnamese rapper Wao Yi. In both Vietnamese and English, Crittenbrink wishes the people of Vietnam a happy Tet.
Chúc mừng năm mới from your boy in Hanoi. Chúc mừng năm mới, spread the joy. Chúc mừng năm mới, cảm mời nói. Tet, Tet, Tet Đến Rồi.
Okay, without even seeing it, you can probably tell the video has a bit of a dorky vibe, but it works. Crittenbrink owns the nerdiness. And if you're wondering what his employer, the State Department, thinks of this, well, as a department spokesperson told CNN, we're glad he's keeping his important day job as a U.S. diplomat.
Time for introductions are at hand. Hi, my name is Dan. I'm from Nebraska. I'm not a big city boy. Then 3 years ago, I moved to Hanoi. Check the calendar, Teddy.
The Biden administration says it has now secured 200 million doses of coronavirus vaccines, but getting them into the arms of Americans is going to take time. There will be plenty of hurdles in the months ahead. That's especially true in Zimbabwe, where relief seems far away. Health workers there are struggling to fight a worsening COVID-19 outbreak on multiple fronts. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, Zimbabweans are feeling the impact of both the pandemic and an economy that was hurting before the pandemic struck.
In a middle-class suburb of Harare, 19-year-old Theophilus Chisunga rings a bell to alert residents of his presence. He's selling ice cream. For more than an hour, as I followed him in this sunny weather around 90 degrees, no one buys Chisunga's ice creams. Chisunga was a musician, but during the pandemic, switched to selling ice cream.
It has affected us mostly in the musical side. If we don't perform, we don't get paid. And on the other side, I'm an ice cream man. Who can I sell ice creams to? Everyone is locked inside.
In January this year, following a spike of COVID-19 cases, the government introduced a tight lockdown, which includes a 12-hour dusk-to-dawn curfew. Dr. Machidiso Moeti is the World Health Organization Regional Director for Africa. She says she's worried by the emergence of a new variant first identified in neighboring South Africa and other variants.
The evidence suggests that these variants are more transmissible, and emerging evidence indicates that the UK variant may cause more severe illness than other common strains, although certainly more research needs to be done.
This comes at a time when health experts say most of the country's laboratories are failing to pick up new variants of COVID-19. Dr. Pamela Magande is president of Zimbabwe College of Public Health Physicians. She says COVID-19 test kits need to be modified to detect the new variants.
What it means is there may be a good number of people who are going around thinking they are negative or having tested negative when they are actually positive, and they could go around and be spreading the disease in the community.
The Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights reports that 30-35% of positive cases are testing negative. Norman Matara is spokesman of the association.
We've actually been treating people for COVID-19 who have negative results because their clinical symptoms and their radiological picture are consistent with COVID-19. Other people will actually become positive on repeat tests, maybe on the second, the third, or even the fourth time.
Prominent Zimbabweans have died from the virus, including several cabinet ministers. Dr. John Mangwiro, Zimbabwe's health deputy minister, says vaccination starts soon.
This vaccine will be given very soon. You will be told where to get your vaccine. The vaccine will be given to the frontline workers first.
Other African countries have started importing the COVID-19 vaccine. Zimbabwe's government says it has been offered 200,000 free vaccines by China. Officials are also asking for assistance for funds to purchase the vaccine for the country's estimated 14 million people. But there's a problem with that. Not everyone is looking forward to the vaccine, as Theophilus Chisunga, the singer, Calm ice cream vendor, says.
If it is true that the vaccine works, then we are grateful. But there are many stories about this vaccine. There are many stories, so we are not sure, we are not confident.
That is another hurdle that Zimbabwe has to jump as part of its efforts to fight coronavirus. For the world, I'm Columbus Mavunga in Harare, Zimbabwe.
If you've ever played poker, or any card game really, you know that it's better to have kings in your hand than queens. Well, Indy Melink, who has played her share of cards in the Netherlands, didn't like the implications of that, so she designed a new gender-neutral deck of cards. Indy Melink joins us now from The Hague. In this new set of cards, Indy, what replaces the king, jack, and queen? And what do these cards look like?
I replace them with the common hierarchy of gold, silver, and bronze, because everybody already knows them from sports. So the gold replaces the king, silver replaces the queen, and bronze replaces the jack. I thought about what would represent like gold best or silver, like what do you think of first? And of course you can do medals, but then all three of them would look the same. So instead I thought gold bars would represent gold, and then silver coins, and bronze looks like a bronze shield instead.
So that's what's printed on the cards, and hence the name of your deck, GSB Cards. What inspired you to make a gender-neutral deck of cards? Were you playing a card game and the thought came to you, this isn't right?
Yeah, it's actually kind of how you described it. Over summer, I was thinking of card games that I would like to play with my friends and family. And I really like playing games and thinking of them myself as well. So then I was thinking of a game and I was going through the explanation in my head. And I was thinking, yeah, okay, standard king above queen above jack. And suddenly when I said that sentence, I was like, wait, what am I saying? So yeah, it just suddenly clicked. And then I started the conversation with my family and I said, yeah, what do you guys think of this? And then somebody should think of an alternative. And that's when my dad said, why don't you think of an alternative? And that's how the whole process started.
Wow. What kind of response have you gotten to the GSB deck so far? Is there a lot of interest? And have you actually started manufacturing and selling them?
We are already selling them. I already started selling in October. And then since January, we've been getting a lot of traction. But the responses have been both positive and negative. People always start with, whoa, I've never thought of that before. And then it can go two ways, either, but I love it, so give me six packs. Or it goes negative, like, oh, but we're going way too far into this gender neutral world or something like that.
Yeah. What do you say to people who say, you know, these are just playing cards. This is the way cards have always looked. What's the big deal about having a king, queen, and a jack? What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I understand where they're coming from. And that's when I try to like highlight the importance of subconscious inequalities, which you see in a card deck. So subconsciously, you are saying like, yeah, the queen is worth less than the king and the jack is worth less than the queen. And that does still influence people in their daily lives, even though you're very unaware of it.
I'm curious, what game were you playing when you came up with this idea?
Yeah, so that's actually a funny question, but it was a self-made game that I thought of. And I've actually now fully worked it out and we're printing it on the back of the box of our double set. But it's kind of a combination between Presidents and BS. If I don't know if you guys are familiar with those card games.
I know BS. Yeah, I used to play it when I was a kid. What do you call your game?
I actually call it Medals. So it's like related to gold, silver, bronze.
Perfect. Indy Melink designed a gender-neutral set of playing cards called GSB Cards. She's been speaking with us from The Hague in the Netherlands. Indy, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, we're not folding, but we are out of time. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and have a great weekend. From PR.